Tonight I want to give a talk I've given before, but I like this talk and I want to come back to it. It's called Let Your Light Shine. And I'm heading someplace, but it's going to take me a little bit of time to get there. First of all, the last time the Buddha taught before he died, he said to his Sangha, who were asking how they could continue, he said, "Therefore, be ye lamps unto yourselves, be a refuge to yourselves, hold fast to the truth as a lamp, hold fast to the truth as a refuge. Look not for a refuge in anyone besides yourselves." It's the last thing the Buddha said. So it's interesting that there's this image of a lamp. Like he's suggesting that it's like the truth, the teachings, the Dhamma are a lamp. They light us up, or they have the potential to give light our path. Right? The image of a lamp occurs throughout all spiritual traditions and religious traditions. The candles on the altar in a Christian church, the menorah in a shul, sacred fire for Hindus. It's like everywhere you go, there is this image of light in the lamp. And it's also very deeply embedded in our sort of colloquial language. There's phrases like, "Don't hide your light under a bushel," right? Which is actually a quote from the Bible. But it's like, we have a light, but we hide it. We don't let it out. If you're like me, and you went to Sunday school as a kid, you sang little songs like, "This little light of mine, I'm gonna let it shine." This was like a little hymn that we used to sing in Sunday school. And it's the same idea. We talk colloquially about finally seeing the light, or seeing the light at the end of the tunnel. Right? All these images have light as being what is valuable and what wakes us up, in a sense. We even talk with the Buddha being in light end. Interesting thought, right? It's just light. So, why is it that we practice? And I think one strong reason we practice is that we bring light into the world for those around us, for others who perhaps need this energy. And maybe we bring it in very indirectly, and we don't go teach the Dhamma to people, that we work with, but we act in a certain way. We give light to their lives, and we try and bring light to our own selves, our own practice. But there's something that prevents us from doing so. And this is all in aid of leading into me talking about the five kilesas. Those things that get in the way of us shining. Right? And so the classic, the five kilesas, right? Yeah. Wanting, craving, lust, grasping is the first one. That wanting something, wanting, wanting, wanting. And when we're in that state, it's like we want something so much that we can't pay attention to what else is going on because we're just caught in the wanting energy itself. Then the flip side of wanting is aversion. Don't want that, which has a lot of flavors. Anger, ill will, hatred, annoyance, irritation. Same thing, only now we get into this obsessive mind state of how can I get rid of this? Oh, it's horrible. Oh, I hate this. All these sort of ideas of aversive energy. And then there's sloth and torpor. I love just the words. And but it's like sluggishness of mind, laziness, that sort of dullness that we encounter. And we're just like, oh, can't do anything, right? I find this, for me, sloth and torpor and hot weather are very strongly related to each other. I have to really watch that I don't just let myself fall into sloth and torpor. The flip side of sloth and torpor, restlessness, worry, regret, agitation. I think it's interesting that worry is in that list. Worry is a form of restlessness. It's a mental restlessness. It's like, oh, what's going to happen? Oh, I don't know what's going to happen. And given our what's going on in the world today, it's pretty easy to get caught up in worry. Like, oh my God, what's that person going to do today? Or however you want to look at it. And regret, I think, is also an interesting one, because regret is like, we think, well, regret's good, right? But regret sort of turns into obsessive beating ourselves up if we're not careful. It's wise to see we've acted inappropriately or spoken inappropriately, and sort of take steps so that it doesn't happen again. But some people sort of, you can turn regret into like wallowing. They're like, oh, I'm so bad, I'm such a bad person, that it isn't helpful. It just, once again, twice we get stuck. And then finally, there's doubt. And doubt is the hard one, the most insidious of the five kleshas, the hardest one to deal with, because doubt always has this sort of logical flavor. It's like, well, of course, that's where the words like, well, of course, that's not true, or of course, blah, blah, blah. And doubt, of course, has different flavors. It has, doubt in the teacher, doubt in the teachings, and doubt in yourself. These are three varieties of doubt. And all three of them, we just get caught in this sort of standstill place where we can't do anything because our mind is just in turmoil. Doubt puts the mind into a state of turmoil. And it's like, oh my God, what about this? And what about that? No, my no. And just, we can't, we get stuck. So now I want to get back to this idea of the light, right? Because typically when people teach about the kleshas, and certainly how I've always heard them until I recently, 4 or 5 years ago, I heard a different interpretation. Recently, it was like the word kalesa gets translated as like obstruction or an obstacle or a block, right? Something solid. It's like we solidify this part of our mind. I mean, because these are just mental arisings, right? They're all just mental arisings. And we turn these mental arisings into something solid and formidable that we have to struggle against. We have to overcome them, remove them. And that idea and that energy often leads to striving. I have to do this. I'm going to do this if it kills me. That energy can very easily arise if we're pushing against, fighting against this obstacle, this block, this obstruction. And the practice becomes really sort of grim because we think, well, this is my nature. I am by nature an angry person, or I am by nature greedy. And I think it's like, so that makes it solid. That's how we solidify it, how it becomes an obstacle, an obstruction. But an alternate way to look at the word kalesa is veil. They cover over our natural light. They block it, dim it, distort it. So the natural, that light, the natural, our Buddha nature, bodhicitta, is there, but these veils distort it, prevent it, dim it. Veils aren't something you struggle with. Right? Veils are like these sort of light gossamer-like cloth things, right? I can just if I want to, I can sort of slide them off. It's a different image, mental image that has a different connotation on how to deal with them. It's not like something we struggle with. We just be aware of it and just give it a little tug and slide it off. And I like that way. The idea of how we clear up the distortions, that because kleshas are always distortions. They get in the way. So when the Buddha is talking about the kleshas, there are two sets of similes in two different teachings that come up over and over and over again. The first set describes quite clearly how they veil or hide our true nature by comparing each kleśa to how a man is prevented from clearly seeing his own face in a bowl of water. 2,500 years ago, a lot of people didn't have mirrors in their houses, but they all had bowls of water, and they could see the reflection in the bowl of water. So it was an image that the Buddha used. And it's interesting to look at these images, because I think they're quite. They illustrate what the Buddha was talking about. This is a book called The Numerical Discourses of the Buddha. Sometimes it's a, these are selections from something called the Anguttara Nikaya. Anguttara just means numerical. And basically, this is a collection of Buddhist teachings where, there's a gazillion lists in the Buddhist teachings, right? So this is like, here's a bunch of the lists with one, just one item and two items and three items, and it goes up to 11. And it's like just a collection of significant teachings of the Buddha that are enumerated in a certain way. So this is from the chapter of fives in the Anguttara Nikaya. And this particular teaching, so this in this teaching, a Brahmin comes to the Buddha and says, Master Gotama, what is the cause and reason why sometimes even those hymns that have been recited over a long period do not occur to the mind, let alone those that have not been recited? What is the cause and reason why sometimes those hymns that have not even been recited over a long period recur to the mind, let alone those that have been recited? So he's saying, this is a Brahmin. Brahmins, their whole cultural practice was to chant certain teachings as a way to answer questions and solve problems. Like there is a certain set of verses that you chanted to help someone have a child. There's certain sets of verses when you planted the crops, and there's certain sets of verses when you harvested the crops, and certain sets of verses you chanted to get the rain to come, and so on and so on. There are verses for everything. And the Brahmin is saying, how come sometimes I can't remember these verses I've chanted forever? And what a surprise is the teaching on the five kleshas. Suppose, Brahmin, this is the first one. Suppose, Brahmin, there's a bowl of water mixed with lac, turmeric, blue dye, or crimson dye. So these are normal cloth dyes that the people would use. If a man with good sight were to examine his own facial reflection in it, he would neither know nor see it as it really is. So if you look at a bowl of water that's colored, then you can't really see your true, you don't get a true reflection. This is the image that the Buddha uses to describe craving. Craving colors our mind. It's like it colors it into the from the well, it'd be nice to. I gotta have it. I gotta have it now. That's the coloring of the mind that turns something into something else that has to be taken care of right now. That's what craving is. It colors the mind. Then it comes to aversion. Again, Brahman, when one dwells with a mind obsessed and oppressed by ill will, and one does not understand as it really is the escape from arisen ill will, on that occasion one neither knows nor sees as it really is one's own good. Suppose, Brahman, there is a bowl of water being heated over a fire, bubbling and boiling. If a man with good sight were to examine his own facial reflection, he would neither know nor see it. So now you're looking down into a bowl of water, and it's bubbling. So it's all, there's no smooth surface, so the reflection is totally distorted. And not only that, it's hot. I mean, a lot of the aversive mind states, when you think about, you know, I was really hot with anger. And there's always a sense of heat that's connected to these aversive mind states. The body actually feels warmer. In fact, that's one of the signs, if you're sort of paying attention to the body and you notice all of a sudden, boy, I feel pretty hot, you might want to go, oh, look at that. I was telling myself this story about that time when blah, blah, blah. You know, but you didn't see it until you noticed the body sensation. Okay. Now we get to sloth and torpor. Suppose, Brahman, there's a bowl of water covered over with water plants and algae. So the water's fine, but there's this scum on top of the water that stops us from actually seeing what's in the bowl at all, because it's all scummy. It's like algae and... That's what sloth and torpor does. Sloth and torpor basically scums up your mind. So it's a really good image in a way, because it's like, it just makes it like, I can't see anything. It's all fuzzy and gooey, and that's the image he uses for that. And I like this particular image. Then it comes to the opposite, restlessness, worry, agitation. Suppose, Brahman, there's a bowl of water stirred by the wind, rippling, swirling, churned into wavelets. When we're restless, that's what our mind is like. It's like, there's like waves. We feel like, oh my God, is this like more is coming? And we can't see anything clearly because it keeps changing all the time. Ever looked, tried to look at water that's wavy? And it's like, never still for a minute. It's always changing. It's going all over the place. And it's funny little ripples and funny sounds. And we can't possibly see clearly in that bowl of water. And finally, it comes to doubt. Suppose, Brahman, there's a bowl of water that is turbid, unsettled, muddy, dark, placed in the dark. If a man with good sight were to examine his own facial reflection, he would neither know nor see it as it really is. So doubt is muddy. It's churned up. It's not like, you know, sloth and torpor, there's this scum. Well, if I just sort of clear the scum away, well, then I get nice clear water again, right? Or if it's windy, I can sort of build a little thing around it to stop the wind. But doubt is like the whole bowl of water is not usable. It's like we keep coming to this place where, but where we keep going, but what about this? What about that? I'm not sure about this. And it's a very unpleasant mind state. Doubt is a very unpleasant mind state, and it's like we keep struggling with it, and we don't get anywhere because we just keep doubting that we can even, we even doubt ourselves that we can figure it out. And that just makes it worse. I'm no good. I can't do this. This is too hard. Or, you know, these teachings just don't make any sense to me. I don't know if these teachings are even any good. That's the words we hear in our mind, or varieties of them, through doubt. And it's, so the whole thing is messed up. The interesting thing, the antidote, the classic antidote for doubt is to go back to the very beginning when you formed your intention to practice and review that intention. Like, look at that intention and go, oh yeah, that's why I'm doing this in the first place. Because often going back and sort of refreshing that intention, reforming it, maybe going a little deeper when you create that intention. Remember, this is at the beginning of the practice, the second step on the Eightfold Path. If we reform our intention and remember our original intention, often that just sort of dispels the doubt. More than anything else, that's dispels the doubt. So those are the five, classic images. And all I like them because they're all sort of common things. I mean, this is part of what I like about the Buddha and his teaching, is that he's talking about things that everybody would understand, especially in his day and his culture. I mean, today, probably not a lot of people go around looking at their image in a bowl of water too often. But back in the day, that was the only way you could see your image, unless you were really wealthy and had a mirror. But that was like extremely wealthy people. Everybody else, that was their mirror. And they all have they have a sort of a flavor to them, so that when we think about these images, the bowl of water that's colored for, craving. Well, that's, it's like, see, I can't see things very clearly. How come it doesn't make, we sort of, that's what craving does to our mind. Like, we lose clarity of mind. The classic physical indication that craving has risen is you're leaning forward. You lean into desire. It's like, I want to reach out and grab something. Right? As I said, anger and aversion, it's heat. Sloth and torpor, it's like dullness, fuzziness. It's like your body really feels sort of like slumpy, right? Agitation is always jumpy. My mother used to tell me sometimes when I was being difficult that I had ants in my pants. And that's how it feels like. Sometimes you just can't sit still. I mean, you're sitting there meditating, and it's like, oh no, I'm not, my body still isn't in the right position. I got to move that hand 3 centimeters to the left. Oh no, I moved it too far. I got to move it back. And just like the body, you can't find physical comfort. That's agitation, mental agitation manifesting in the body. And doubt is always tight. We feel a certain, we're gripped. People talk about being gripped by doubt. So then there's this second set. Read a little bit of Enlil here too. Says Enlil's, he's talking about the five similes I just talked about very briefly. He says, these similes vividly illustrate the individual character of each hindrance, sensual desire, colors one perception. Because of aversion, one gets heated. Sloth and torpor results in stagnation. Through restlessness and worry, one is tossed about, and doubt obscures. I like that. That's it's like that term, that water that's full of mud and it obscures clear seeing. That's what doubt does. But then the second set of similes is like, what does it feel like when we cease? And I'm not going to read the whole simile, but I want to just read Enlil's understanding of it here. The other set of similes illustrates the absence of the hindrance. According to this set, to be free from sensual desire is like being relieved from a debt. Ever been in debt and then such relief? And it's just because the debt clouds how we function in the world. I got to pay off the debt, and we start acting in ways that maybe we wouldn't normally act because we got to deal with the debt. To be free from aversion is like recovering from physical illness. You know, we've had a fever, the heat of the body over in the reverse of mind states. It's like having a fever. And then when it goes away, it's like everything cools down again. To be unobstructed by sloth and torpor is akin to being released from prison. To be free from agitation or restlessness and worry is like being liberated from slavery. Pretty strong image. And to overcome doubt resembles crossing a dangerous desert safely. So once again, these are classic images that the Buddha uses that everybody would understand. Then Anileo goes on. This second set of similes provides additional illustrations of the hindrances. Sensual desire, agitating the mind, is comparable to being heavily in debt. The tension created through aversion is quite literally a dis-ease. Sloth and torpor dulls and imprisons the mind. Restlessness and worry can control the mind to such an extent that one is completely at its mercy, being a slave. And doubt leaves one in a state of insecurity, not knowing which way to turn. The thing about these images, both the ones that illustrate what the kalesas are, and the ones that illustrate what it's like to be free from them, indicate ways we can see how to work skillfully with the kalesas. First of all, we have to recognize them. Number one, better recognize, if you don't see the kalesas in the first place, they're in control. You're stuck in some unskillful, you're mismeditating, as Anileo would say. You know, we're caught in this whirling mind state of one swarm or another. And then, remember the instructions in the kalesas, and this is in the fourth foundation of mindfulness, and mindfulness of the Dhammas. The second instruction is know when it's there, but also know when it's not there. And when it's not there, you get a feeling sort of like, I was in prison. I was enslaved. I had a fever and now it's gone. That describes the sensation we can actually see and note. So these illustrations are useful pointers to how we can interpret what's arisen that we've noted. And it's really important that we understand that the instruction is that not only do we see those things as they arise, but also we see that they're gone, that they're not there. If we just note, and it's very easy to turn yourself into an obsessive kalesa noter, where all you see are all the bad things. Oh, I'm just full of this, and now I'm full of that, and now I've got what one of my teachers called an MKA, a multiple kalesa attack. You know, you've got you're full of aversion, and then you doubt your ability to practice multiple places. Right? And it's important that we sort of accept that none of what's arising, these kalesas, all they do is veil our true nature. Back to the image of the veil. They stop the light from shining forth. And we just need to clear them out of the way. You clean up the bowl, filter the water. To use images along with the bowl thing. It's like it takes effort, but we can. It's not like, oh, nothing I can do about this. And it's really important that we don't blame ourselves. It's not like, oh, I'm so bad. I'm just full of sloth and torpor today. What's wrong with me? Or whatever your favorite, pick your favorite Kalesa, right? We all have favorites. It's just, all it does is create that more doubt and more aversion. We now take, we're experiencing the Kalesa and then we add another one on top. Let's make it really hard to dig ourselves out of this hole. Right? But once we're mindful of the hindrance, once we're actually mindful of it, we can see that there's no solidity there. It's just no permanence. It's just, there's simply some mental arising that's occurred. And now, when they arise, we just need to see them. We need to note them. And this is where noting is can be really skillful. Like we say, we can actually go and note aversion, anger, sloth and torpor, worry, doubt, whatever. Pick your favorite kleśa again. That's the primary antidote to all of the kleśas. It's just noting them. And this is the other thing I think that is really, this is brilliant from the way the Buddha teaches. This thing that was a problem, that we saw as a problem, that we saw that was veiling, that is sometimes classically talked about as an obstruction, now just becomes the object of meditation. Oh, this is what's arisen. I'm aware of it. I note it. I'm paying attention to it. It's not a problem now. It's just what's there. There's nothing wrong with it. It's just this is what I'm noting right now. You just shift your attitude towards them in a sense. It's an attitude adjustment. Oh, this is just what's here now, and that's okay. It's like it's only when you think it isn't okay, when you think it's a problem, when you think there's something wrong with you, that you make it into a way bigger problem. It's not pleasant. These things, none of these things are pleasant. I won't deny that. But they're just, oh, this unpleasant thing is here now. Let's just pay attention to it. Note it. Be aware of it. Don't let it be anything other than what it is. It's just, see, it's temporary arise nature. It just arises. It's gone. Then note the feeling when it's gone. Because it all they all go. We tend to make big deals about all these things, make them into some amazing, difficult thing. And they're just things that are just passing through the mind, just like everything else. And some of them are pretty habitual. That's the other thing about these, is that they have typically the stories we tell ourselves over and over and over again, our favorite stories, all have at least one, if not multiple, kleśas attached to the story. And it's sometimes skillful when you sort of look at the story and you can sort of step back and see it's just the story and you can go, oh, this is how I wind myself up. By telling myself this story over and over and over again. And every time I tell myself this story, I get wound up and angry and upset. Want to get revenge on that horrible person who did that horrible thing and blah, blah, blah. We get lost in that space. But they're just stories. They're just things that arise and they're there for a while and they're gone. And we can see that, then they're not, they lose their power. They're only a problem when we don't see them. Once we see them clearly, It just, this is what's arisen, and that's what I'm noting. Where's the problem now? Like I say, it isn't going to be pleasant, but then we know that lots of things aren't pleasant when we pay attention to them. But that's all we're doing, is just paying attention to them, knowing they're there and seeing them for what they are, and not fighting against them, not trying to fix ourselves, or thinking there's something wrong. There's one other line from Enlileo I wanted to share from this book. He's talking about if the kilesas are no longer present, there's this sort of this tranquil state of mind. Once the hindrances are at least temporarily removed, the alternative aspect of contemplating the hindrance becomes relevant: awareness of their absence. In several expositions of the gradual path, such absence of the hindrances forms the starting point for a causal sequence that leads via the light, joy, tranquility, and happiness to concentration and attainment of absorption. So seeing that one of those the kilesas is gone is the beginning, or can be the beginning, of this process where we go, oh, isn't it great it's gone? But not, sort of, aren't I wonderful because I got rid of it? Just, isn't it great? Doesn't it feel great? It feels good. Note the joy, note the happiness of that feeling. And that leads towards tranquility and concentration. And then he analyzes this one thing. Several discourses refer to such a tranquil state of mind, temporarily unaffected by the hindrances or a mental defilement, as luminous. Luminous. Oh, here we are back to light. That's what it feels like. You feel like you're glowing. It's luminous. In deep states of concentration, sometimes that sort of luminosity is quite actively present, where you actually have a sense that you're glowing. There's all these stories about people encountering the Buddha, and there's something about him that is like this light shining from you. It's luminous. And that's when I said at the beginning, what we're trying to do with this whole practice is to become sources of light. That's what happens. People, when you're deeper into the practice, when you practice, then you have a sort of a stronger sense of it. People just sense that. They're luminous, giving off these waves of calm and stillness that people feel. And typically, they find this quite pleasant to be around you, just to be around that energy, to be around someone who's luminous. Excuse me, while I don't go really good on the recording, but I want to finish with a little bit of poetry here. This is from Mary Oliver's book Thirst, and it's a poem I really like, called "When the Roses Speak, I Pay Attention." A garden's full of flowers these days, so this comes to mind. As long as we are able to be extravagant, we will be hugely and damply extravagant. Then we will drop foil by foil to the ground. This is our unalterable task, and we do it joyfully. And then they went on, "Listen, the heart shackles are not, as you think, death, illness, pain, unrequited hope, not loneliness, but lassitude, rue, vainglory, fear, anxiety, selfishness." Sounds like a list of the vices. Vidarbhi. Listen, the heart chakras are not as you think. Death, illness, pain, unrequited love, not loneliness, but lassitude, rue, vainglory, fear, anxiety, selfishness. Their fragrance all the while rising from their blind bodies, making me spin with joy. We understand the kalesas when we can start to skillfully work with them. We start to spin with joy. Literally, maybe. That's what the Sufis are doing anyway. So that's what I have to share with you today.